May 2020, I tweet for the first time, now is the best time in human history to start a capital-intensive deep tech space company. The tweet goes super viral, and then I'm like, oh God.
Delian Asparov, the world's first space drug dealer. Delian is the co-founder and chairman at Varda, a revolutionary company building infrastructure and pharmaceuticals in outer space to advance humankind here on Earth.
We're making the next generation cancer compound, which you can't make down here on Earth, that could actually tackle a significant portion of cancers.
What do you think your chances of success are?
We have 40 or 50% chance now. 4 years ago, sub 1%. Space is not just this place for exploration, but it can actually be a place for trade and economic activity.
Why do you think it's so important to marry well and early?
It is the thing that you're here on this planet to do. Anything that Varda does pales in comparison to my four-month-old son giggling to me in the mornings.
What are one or two skills that you think all entrepreneurs should really focus on mastering? Welcome back to the World Class Podcast. Today, I sit down with one of the most ambitious entrepreneurs of our generation and the world's first space drug dealer, Delian Asparov. Delian is a partner at Founders Fund, and he is the co-founder and chairman of Varda, a revolutionary company building infrastructure and pharmaceuticals in outer space to advance humankind here on Earth. And in this conversation, we discuss how to accomplish Elon Musk moonshot goals, how to assemble world-class teams to make those goals a reality, and Delian's advice on how to be fulfilled along the journey. So without further ado, let's dive in. All right, Delian, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm super pumped, man. You are, I feel like you're like our generation's Elon Musk.
I've got a ways to go, but I appreciate that.
No, it's really fascinating because you're building the definition of a moonshot. And there's a lot of people that have big ideas for their businesses, for their, you know, they have big dreams, but you're building a space company and a biotech company and some other stuff wrapped into one. So I just love to know what is Varda exactly and what is your guys' mission?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with the mission because that relates to what we do. The one-liner mission of Varda, which it has been the exact same since the very first day of the company. It was funny, we started with 10 people at the company on one day. We had a big old empty warehouse. We just sat on four couches with a whiteboard and literally just for the first 3 hours of the company's life, just brainstormed. We had values that we were trying to build towards. We were how do we encapsulate this into a single sentence? And this is basically what we came up with after a couple hours, which is the mission of Varda is to expand the economic bounds of humankind. There's sort of two core components of that. One is economic bounds. If you think about the economic activity that happens today in all humanity, it basically all happens on the surface of the Earth. And I would actually argue that things like Starlink and Planet Labs aren't really expanding the economic bounds because they're fundamentally transacting entirely in the world of basically bits, where Starlink satellites fly up to orbit and for sure they're atoms, but in terms of how they generate value for down here on Earth, it's entirely via radio waves. They're not sending anything back. Versus Varda's business model, which is to do in space manufacturing, which I'll touch on more in depth, requires actually sending basically atoms, back down. And so again, it's expanding the economic bounds of atoms based, let's say, businesses beyond the surface of the Earth. And then the second half is of humankind. So while Varda today is fully automated, there are no humans on board, the sort of fundamental thesis is if you look over the course of human history, the only time where there's ever been a sustained human presence has been when there's been sustained basically economic activity. You can study in the 15th century, the approach that the Chinese versus the Portuguese took to their merchant and naval fleets. You can study the early days of the American colonies and why they actually survived. All of these things ultimately were only ever sustained when there was true basically economic activity. And so the thesis was start off with expanding the economic bounds. And then over time, that's what really expands humankind's, presence and bounds. And so we really, our thesis and my, growing up in the Soviet Union and the fall of it, sort of pure capitalist anti-communist thesis about how we actually make humanity multiplanetary is it only happens through economic measures. It's not ever going to happen through larger and larger rockets, larger and larger state budgets. Mm-hmm. Those are fundamentally communistic in some ways, measures.
Yep. Yep.
The only way that it happens is through basically, transaction and trade. And I don't see that, being talked about enough. People talk about the lunar bases, the Mars bases, et cetera, but nobody talks about what is the fundamental, trade. And our idea was, the easiest trade is stay very close to Earth, manufacture things close to Earth, and then bring them down. That's the first trading post. And we sort of build our way from there. So that's the mission. So what does sort of Varda in practice do? We basically took the easiest, let's say, step towards creating trade in space, which is we basically manufacture pharmaceutical products using precursors that are created down here on Earth. We take them up on rockets and put them inside of basically small space factories that we build ourselves. We then manufacture those pharmaceuticals in the microgravity environment of low Earth orbit. And that microgravity environment just offers a very unique, set of behaviors in terms of how chemical systems work that are not possible to replicate basically down here on Earth. And there can be a very different set of outcomes to chemical systems and pharmaceuticals. Some might be worse than what you see on Earth, but some can be far, far better. And this fundamental science has been shown and proven over the past 40 years on everything from the early days of the space shuttle to Skylab to eventually the International Space Station, and not just by like individual researchers. A lot of the sort of top 20 largest biopharma companies in the world have done work on the International Space Station with really incredible results. Eli Lilly, Merck, Janssen & Janssen, a multitude of others that have shown that there is promise. But really, nobody's created a sort of like commercial off-ramp where a human-rated government-run station, as you can imagine, is an okay place to do research. But dear God, do not integrate that into your supply chain. I do not want the U.S. government anywhere near any of my sort of supply chains, nor do these pharmaceutical companies. And so we basically manufacture these pharmaceuticals in orbit on behalf of basically publicly traded sort of biopharma companies. And then once it's finished, you can actually bring those pharmaceuticals back down, maintain the benefits that you got in space, and then effectively distribute them to patients down here on Earth. And so we did this for the first time, sort of June of 2023, launched on a Falcon 9 SpaceX rocket. We were up in orbit for about 8 months, a little longer than expected, and then brought down those first pharmaceutical products February 21st of 24. So about, a month and 4 days before this podcast was recorded. And we actually just published our pharmaceutical results from that first campaign last week, basically showing that we were able to fabricate exactly, as expected. But yeah, that's a bit about the mission.
That is, yeah, it's just remarkable. We're going to go way deeper into this. I want to just go back in time a little bit and understand how you got here. Where did the obsession with space first begin for you?
In some ways, probably before even my current memory, it's like
in your past life.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. As like a kid, I was always just obsessed, sort of with space. I was reading sci-fi, space movies, et cetera, sort of nonstop. I knew that it was always a place that I wanted to, figure out how to go to myself, and always something that I wanted to be basically involved in. And then around the specifics of just like some of these industrial use cases in space, I really got obsessed in like 2011, 12 when Google X launched the Lunar Prize with Peter Diamandis. And the primary prize was if you drove a rover on the moon for 100 meters and basically live streamed it, you were awarded $20 million. However, there were a bunch of sub prizes around a couple of different industrial use cases in space manufacturing, lunar ice mining and asteroid mining. And that was the first time that it sort of opened this idea of, space is not just this place for exploration, but it can actually be a place for, sort of trade and economic activity. And again, as somebody who grew up with these extremely, sort of anti-communist ideals, it just like unlocked this immediate sort of like interest where I was like, here is how you like can truly apply the ideals of capitalism to outer space. And so, yeah, got obsessed with the sort of idea back then. When I originally dropped out of school in 2013, I debated whether or not this should be the field that I would immediately go into, because there were a set of companies that started up around this time around some of these Google X Prize ideas. Planetary Resources was a company doing asteroid mining back in 2012. Made in Space, doing in space manufacturing, and what was it called again? Lunar Express, which was basically doing this like moon rover eventually meant to be, lunar ice mining. I think at the time I just felt these companies are probably too early, and I'm not sure that I just want to be an individual engineer. If you look at the people that are the most impactful in the world of space, again, in 2012 at the time, the archetype was basically somebody that made it big in like normal tech, and then went and like took their money and applied it to space.
Right, like Fred Adcock from Figure.
Yeah. Or like, Bezos or Chamath or Elon, et cetera. They all kind of follow that same, sort of trajectory. And so the thinking was, let me go do my like, you know, normal tech thing first. And then I'll pivot basically, you know, sort of back into space, you know, sort of when the time is right. And originally thought that it was going to have to be like, you know, 15, 20 years in like normal tech. But in some ways, I think Elon really, you know, lowered the barriers to entry through reusable rockets in a way that made it much more tractable. And so in some ways,
more economical.
So I actually ended up like, you know, sort of pivoting back towards space much quicker than I expected, which is, you know, I probably did like, you know, normal tech for, you know, about 5 years.
So you had that dream when you were in fifth grade. But you were like, all right, I got to find the right timing. I got to acquire skill sets, and it's got to be the right time in my life for it. Because you were an immigrant too, right?
From Bulgaria. So I was born in Sofia, Bulgaria, and then immigrated to the United States when I was about 3.5 years old. But then, you know, would still go back every summer and maintain a strong, you know, connection there. You know, still continue to go back basically every summer for a decent chunk of time.
Yeah, because you mentioned that you had very strong anti-communist ideals, right? And that probably shaped a lot about how you think as an entrepreneur too, just from the experience you had there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny, you know, I always get asked on like, you know, Bulgarian national TV all the time, like, you know, how does the, you know, Bulgarian mindset help you in the United States? And I think it's such an easy, you know, sort of answer, which is, you know, for it's so obvious to me when I meet somebody that is, you know, sort of born in America, raised in America, and only understands, you know, the current ecosystem that they live in. Because they tend to just be, you know, sort of these like super entitled, you know, sort of, you know, freaks of nature that don't appreciate that they're living in one of the most glorious countries on the planet and the most glorious, you know, sort of period in all of human history. And yet they constantly find things basically to complain about and, you know, worry about when they should honestly, you know, be perfectly, you know, sort of happy. And I think, you know, somebody that, you know, has watched a, you know, sort of country get ravaged by, you know, sort of communism and have its, you know, sort of progress so stalled out for, you know, sort of so many years, I think it just gives you an appreciation for the current life and the current, you know, sort of culture that the United States has is not a given. Like it could very easily, you know, sort of fall apart and we could, you know, go by the wayside. In some ways, watch what's happened in Western Europe over the course of the last 15 years, right? You know, 2008, you know, the United Kingdom and the United States were pretty similar in terms of, you know, GDP per capita. At this point, the United Kingdom is like, you know, sort of steadily sliding towards a second world country. And I'm pretty skeptical that, you know, they're going to be the place where there's going to be a first spaceport, you know, in Europe. Almost certainly, I think some of the Nordic and Eastern European countries are going to beat them out because for some reason there, they actually still seem to, you know, believe in the values of hard work versus as far as I can tell. Western Europe, they seem to have totally, you know, sort of lost that. So yeah, I think it just gives you this appreciation for how fragile it can be to, you know, have what we have in the United States and then a deeper appreciation for it and a deeper motivation to take advantage, you know, of it. I think something like Varda is not possible literally anywhere else in the entire, you know, sort of world. The, you know, audaciousness, the ability to recruit talent to actually tackle this audacious of idea, the ability to fundraise for this audacious of an idea, like everywhere else, you just get, you know, sort of laughed out of the room. And so, yeah, I think it just, you know, it makes you dream bigger in some ways because you have to take advantage of the fact that like my parents worked their ass off to get here, right? They moved to the United States with $600 in their pocket and, you know, I needed to take advantage of everything that they, you know, sort of provided, you know, for me versus you see most trust fund kids, if anything, they're trying to waste away all the, you know, sort of resources that their parents gave them.
That's a great point. So you grew up in Bulgaria. You moved here when you were 3.5 years old. You had this dream for space. I know you were pretty damn good at math too, right? So you had this space obsession. You were damn good at math. You got to MIT and you had some fun events at MIT. Did you hacked the servers there or something? What happened at MIT and why did you decide to drop out?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're, you know, somewhat, you know, related, somewhat unrelated. You know, sort of
yeah, decisions. I'm curious. Unpack those for us.
Yeah. Let's see, you know, I originally started thinking that I should maybe not stay at MIT indefinitely in the summer after my freshman year, where I ended up going to work at Square as one of the like very early engineers. You know, when I did my recruiting, the company was probably like 120 people. When I joined, it was like 160. We scaled to like 300 people over the course of that summer. And so I ended up being like one of the more senior engineers on my team in terms of, you know, time at the company. And like when I was leaving the internship, most people thought that I was a full-timer. Got to spend like a decent amount of time, like one-on-one with, you know, Jack Dorsey, which like as a 19-year-old, like, you know, computer science student, you just realize, oh my God, there's so much more to the world than just like, you know, software, you know, sort of engineering. And so I got back to MIT and I just was like, I felt so disillusioned where I was like, I learned so much more in Silicon Valley and in the 3 months there than I did my entire freshman year at MIT. Yeah. What in God's name am I doing at this school? Like I need to be out in, you know, Silicon Valley basically as soon as possible. So immediately started architecting and thinking about, you know, how do I, you know, sort of do this, you know, winter break of, you know, basically sophomore year, I ended up applying for the Thiel Fellowship. It was a program that I learned about. And that was, you know, ultimately basically how, what I was awarded. And a part of, you know, I think I was going to drop out either way, but that obviously made it much more, you know, sort of financially viable, given that not like I was, you know, coming from a, you know, wealthy family and definitely not a family that was supportive of the idea of dropping out. So I was definitely, you know, sort of on my own if I wanted to, you know, do this. And then, you know, maybe about a month or two before dropping out, I was in my fraternity at like, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. And, MIT is very big on like mailing lists and email lists, and people always set up like sub lists. And so one of the sub lists at our fraternity was this thing called, you know, we were like, Phi Sigma Kappa. So PSK. Mm-hmm. And so it was PSK dash red pants. Basically in order to be allowed onto this email list, you had to own, bright red pants. At MIT, you would also regularly, rather than sending email as yourself individually, you would send emails from the mailing list. And so basically this like red pants email list would send red pants related jokes to the broader, basically like fraternity list. So, you know, sort of one day I went up to, you know, one of my friends, like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I don't even remember what it was, but I basically told him, I was like, I have a funny joke for the red pants, like email list to send out. Do you mind if I like, you know, sort of send it out? Give me access to the list real quick. And he was like, no, like we are very strict on like admission into the list. You have to wear red pants, or you have to own red pants in order to be allowed onto this list. And I was like, okay, well, whatever. I don't actually care about being on the list. I just want to send an email as if I'm on the list, and just send it out to the broader fraternity. And I actually don't need your permission to do that. Like I can spoof that super easily. He's like, what do you mean you can spoof it? Like you don't have access to the list. And I was like, bro, it's email. It's like this open protocol. It's incredibly easy to spoof being anybody. I could pretend to be the president of MIT and send an email to the entire campus if I wanted to. Like, that's very easy to spoof. It would only take me like 15 minutes. And my friend goes, fuck you. Like, no way. Like, you know, show that you can go do it. And so like 1:30 in the morning, I was, you know, drunk, wrote up. And it's like, it's not, again, it's not like a particularly difficult thing to do. It's like 7 lines of, you know, I think I wrote it in PHP, you know, basically back then. But yeah, I composed an email. I like grabbed the president's email from like earlier in the day where at the time, you know, kind of funny, you know, situation. But at the time we were going through this like Aaron Schwartz situation, who's basically one of the original co-founders of Reddit. MIT basically sued him for trying to release scientific articles in the wild. He ended up committing suicide. And so anyways, the president had sent out an email about the situation earlier in the day. I basically had like copied and pasted that email, changed up some of the wording to make it seem like there was more going on, but that because of what was going on, my specific phrase was there were threats from the media, which, you know, doesn't necessarily make sense. Not like Fox News is going to be like calling in bomb threats. But anyways, I said there were threats from the media. And so that was why we needed to shut down school basically the next day.
So you sent an email saying we got to shut down school.
Yeah. Like 1:30 in the morning to like everybody at the school, which it turns out if you do that, the school does have to shut down the next day because like,
so the school was, shut down.
Well, yeah, it was like finals week and everybody got an email at 1 o'clock in the morning saying like school shut down tomorrow. You don't have to go to your finals. And so like, you know, students went to bed and stopped studying and then like obviously didn't set alarms for the next day. So like, screw it, like school shut down. Anyways, a bunch of finals did have to like, you know, get rescheduled. But yeah, so I send this at like, you know, maybe like 1:30 in the morning. By 2:30 in the morning, there was basically like banging. I also like realized very quickly what had happened. And again, maybe stupid and drunk, at 2 o'clock in the morning, decided to send an email to the entire campus, basically being like, this was a prank. And like, this was sent by me, Delian. At 2:30 in the morning, MIT police and Boston police basically, you know, show up, you know, slamming down our door, basically put me in handcuffs, arrest me, throw me in the back of the van, drive me to this like nondescript room in the middle of somewhere in Cambridge, and basically start interrogating me. I think also with a guy that like, you know, was basically with the FBI. Because they thought it was like a politically motivated, like related to the Aaron Schwartz thing. They were like, you know, do you have like allegiances to like hacker groups? You know, was this a political statement? Like, you know, what were you trying to do with this? And the entire time I was like, bro, I just wanted to send a fucking joke as the red pants, like, you know, list. It's like really not that deep.
Yeah.
So anyways, they ended up, you know, like letting me out after like an hour and a half or something, you know, of questioning. And then the next day there was like 14, 15 news trucks on campus, like everybody trying to get in touch with me. I obviously did not go to any of my classes that day because I was like, oh my God. I was definitely disliked by a certain set of very academically oriented students, you know, on campus that were not happy that I disrupted the like academic flow of MIT for a day.
So you dropped out of MIT, you joined the Thiel program.
Yeah.
People don't know, it's led by Peter Thiel, iconic entrepreneur and investor, where you get more practical hands-on experience building startups. I think he pays about $100,000 to give you a salary to go build an idea or work on a startup, right?
Yeah, it's pretty loose in terms of, you know, sort of programming. It's basically just like, yeah, here's 100K over the course of, you know, sort of 2 years. You know, basically, you know, go build a startup and you have to have applied for it. And one of the qualifications is you need to have basically dropped out of school. You can't have taken a traditional, basically, you know, sort of college path.
Do you believe that traditional school at any level now is worth going to? Or do you think it's better just to go straight and start building?
I think that answer is highly dependent on the individual. You know, I think I was particularly sort of precocious, independent, and sort of ready to, you know, sort of live
rebellious.
On my own. Yeah, rebellious. Yeah. And I had like a clear vision of what I wanted to do. I think for people that are, you know, a little bit more, you know, sort of lost in life post high school and aren't quite sure what they want to do with themselves and maybe, you know, haven't built a level of independence from their parents, I actually think that, you know, college is a very valuable sort of like transition, you know, sort of point.
Yeah.
Good point. Should you be spending like $50,000 at like XYZ liberal arts university for like a philosophy degree that now you're going to be in debt for indefinitely? No.
Probably not.
Should you do like $6K a year at like a state school and just like, you know, get a valuable skill set like in engineering or, you know, mathematics where again, maybe it's not the thing that you love, but at least you know there's like a fallback plan of like you can do valuable things for society? Yeah, that I think is really valuable. And like, yeah, I really do think, you know, people should spend time in like the, whatever, Greek culture, party, you know, have fun. Like, yeah, I do think it's a just fun time to be co-located with a bunch of people your age that are all relatively, you know, able to have spontaneous, you know, sort of get togethers. Like, right. I do think that is a very, you know, I'm very glad that I went to MIT for, you know, call it a year and a half, 2 years. Like,
yeah.
I do think my life would be very different without, you know, basically that experience.
Yeah.
I definitely see kids that go straight from high school, straight into, you know, sort of Silicon Valley, you know, sort of building and, I think there's just like, you know, a level of just like socialization that like I got to. I was like the geekiest kid, you know, in high school at MIT. I was like the frightiest, you know, sort of kid, but it's just because of the standard there was so low. You know what I mean? It's just like, you don't have to be that social to be like cool at MIT. You know what I mean?
You were the hot shot.
Yeah, I was the hot shot. Like I knew how to like make eye contact, you know, like that was great. Cause like, it kind of like that encourages you to actually realize like, actually I can do this thing. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I can both be a very good engineer and mathematicist and, you know, physicist and also, you know, like, talk to people. And so, you know, maybe one day I can become, you know, Richard, you know, Feynman, you know, womanizer.
So when you look at your sequence, I want to like kind of looking back at hindsight 2020, you see how the dots connect, right? There were certain things that you kind of had to do to get to the point where you were ready for Varda. And obviously some of that's market conditions and you kind of found the right time. I know there was like zero interest rates, which paved the way to be able to raise a lot of capital, which is super important for a business like yours. But when you look at that, you started at Square. You worked in Silicon Valley, then you started a company called Nightingale, right?
Yep.
What was Nightingale and what was your experience building that and really how did it set you up for Varda?
Yeah, do you think I would not have been able to take a swing like Varda if not for basically having built a, you know, sort of prior company? And it's not that it even went, you know, sort of phenomenally well. I started Varda in some ways, maybe for like the wrong reasons, where I just really wanted to get out of MIT and out to Silicon Valley. And I felt like at my age, it didn't make sense to like just go back and take a full-time offer at a place like Square. You know, this is a time of life where I could take a ton of risk. And so I should just go, you know, sort of build something. And so in some ways I was like starting a company for starting a company's sake than I was for like an idea that I was particularly passionate about, or had a ton of unique insights on. And so Nightingale was effectively this tool for like behavioral and speech therapists in early childhood autism therapy. There was basically like a workflow tool for them to basically collect data around the kids' behaviors and also submit that to insurance for reimbursement. And, you know, learned a ton through that experience, like, you know, basically worked on the idea for about, you know, basically 3.5 years, you know, sort of straight. And a part of why I made it to sort of 3.5 year mark is up until then, I'd had a lot of my mentors, you know, sort of in college and that I'd met in San Francisco, they'd basically consistently tell me, hey, Dalian, like, you're great, but like you switch between ideas and things that you work on like every 3 months, you're never going to build anything of value unless you like really at least for 3 years straight, put your head towards one idea. And so I kind of forced myself where I was like, you know, I don't know if this is like the best idea in the world, but it's kind of the one that I've got right now. And I'm just going to force myself to work on this, you know, sort of for 3 years, even if I start to get basically like, you know, bored with it, with the idea, which, you know, I definitely, you know, sort of did, you know, all throughout. But look, that company, like, you know, we went through Y Combinator, we raised like a, you know, sort of 700K or so, you know, sort of seed round. We got to like, you know, ramen profitability, I think over the course of the company's life, like we probably did, I don't know, like, you know, 200K in revenue or something like that, maybe 150K. Peak month at one point was like, you know, maybe like 15-20K a month basically in revenue. And, you know, learn how to do everything from sales to marketing to, you know, sort of customer support, hiring, firing, managing people. You know, we got to like, I think at peak, we were a team of like, you know, sort of 5 or 6 people. So again, it's not like some like massive scale, but still, right. If you imagine somebody that had previously just been like purely a software engineer, that was like my only skill set.
Yeah.
I had to very rapidly expand. Like I had to like, yeah, write the like financing docs. I had to like negotiate the early contracts with customers. I had to do all the customer support. I like had an app on my phone where I was like, I was using Intercom back in the day and like literally doing customer support myself directly. And so I think it like, you know, in some ways unveiled, you know, the like, or like opened the veil behind here's how the rest of the world basically functions versus I felt like up until then, I only knew sort of how software functioned. And in some ways, yeah, I did find it to be very relevant. Whereas like even just in the early days of Varda, just like the idea of like, what are the first steps? It's like, oh yeah, I don't know how to do that. It's like, yeah, you incorporate the company. You have to decide on equity splits. You have to like, you know, find the first office. You have to decide what the early founding team looks like. In some ways, I like felt very, you know, sort of natural, you know, sort of doing it, you know, in you know, part number two. And that like, you know, there's that special like, you know, and yeah, I'm sure I'll get to experience it again in that in life. But like, there's those really special early days of like what I call like the like negative one to zero days, which is just like most of company stories, in some ways, Varda stories, really starts like, you know, whatever it was, January 21st, 2021, which is like the day that we opened the office doors and we had like a 10-person team basically and like, you know, funding in the bank. But in some ways, like, you know, the Varda story really starts, you know, July earlier that year when it was the first time where I was like, I'm going to work on this, you know, sort of full time.
Yeah.
And there's all those just like early, like, how do you even like, you know, convince people to be your co-founder and like that the idea has merit. What should, again, like, what should the equity split be amongst like the co-founder, right? The co-founders. And like, there's so much of that, like, you know, sort of pre-story that you only go through, you know, sort of once versus in some ways everything afterwards when you have an office and employees. Yeah, we have more employees now, et cetera. We have a bigger office, but it kind of feels like the same versus right. Like the negative one to zero is like just a, you know, sort of special time. And I think like having done it before made me much more confident actually like doing it, you know, sort of quite aggressively in terms of like, I knew exactly what I wanted in terms of team. I knew exactly what I wanted in terms of funding. Cause I was like, I've seen how I did it last time and like, you know, didn't yes. You know, sort of do it well. But yeah, we ultimately, you know, Nightingale, you know, continued to function even after we like stopped working on it full time. It still had customers and revenue, et cetera. We just realized we weren't able to grow it at the level that we wanted. And so we all sort of split off and, you know, sort of did different things afterwards. But it continued to function. And I think it was even like 2 years later where I was like, I'd actually like worked at this company Teespring for a full year. I then had joined Coastal Ventures as chief of staff. And I remember 3 or 4 months into Coastal Ventures where I was like, bro, I can't still be doing customer support for like my startup. Yeah, it's like, you know, at this point it's like 2 years.
What was your thought process on that? Because you had a startup, you got some really good experience, which I think is an undervalued thing in startups. Most people don't have a moonshot their first hit, right? It's like, totally. You got to go to there, get the reps, make the mistakes. Like I had a buddy who built a company. He had a pretty legit exit for a first company, $20 million, but he didn't know how to negotiate equity and the VCs got the best of him. He ended up with, I think, 4 or 5 million.
Yep.
But that taught him the lesson on how to structure a cap table. His next company, he became a billionaire.
Yep.
And, you know, owned more equity than I think most public CEOs in history. But it's the arena where you have the learning ground where you're just making a shit ton of mistakes to figure out who you are and to build the confidence, like you said too, because I think confidence comes from reps, getting enough reps in to where the unfamiliar becomes familiar.
Totally.
Right. And you're no longer like, your nervous system is no longer afraid of that thing. You're like, all right, now I can like take even bigger swings because I'm like a little bit more comfortable here. So for you, you got some of that at Nightingale, but then you went pretty hardcore into investing, right? You were the chief of staff for Keith Your Boy.
Yep.
At Kosala. Legend. Love Keith. What was that experience like working with Keith at Kosala, and how did that journey as an investor kind of further your career and prepare you for this?
Yeah. So when I shut down Nightingale, I always knew it was like, yeah, this is the first company. I absolutely, you know, want to start, you know, something again. It's not a question. I've learned, you know, sort of so much. I took a sort of like, call it like year-long detour working at this company, Teespring, partially because Keith was involved in the company. And I was like, this is a great way for us to continue to, you know, sort of work together. And there were a lot of great people around the company trying to advise and like help it in a bit of a turnaround. And because it was a turnaround situation, as a like 22-year-old single-time failed entrepreneur, I just got way more budget responsibilities, et cetera, because like the company was just really struggling to recruit basically anybody, you know, with any level of, you know, sort of competence to, you know, sort of come join the company. And then after a year, I was like, okay, I'm ready to start something again. I was pulling together a founding team around this like cybersecurity insurance idea. For a variety of reasons, the other co-founders decided to go after a different business model. And so I was like, basically done with my detour. I had the idea that I wanted, but like, you know, the founding team kind of fell apart. And I was basically chatting with Keith and he was like, hey, why don't you like basically come work with me? And as long as just, you know, all I ask is like, please stick around for at least a year. Like, don't, you know, leave after like 3 or 4 months. Cause it's going to take me some time to like train you up, get you integrated, et cetera. I want at least like, you know, sort of get some value out of it before you like leave. And you can use this as a platform to like noodle on more ideas, noodle on co-founders, et cetera, and, you know, go build your second company. And so the explicit original plan being Keith's chief of staff was this is going to be a 1 year gig. And then I'm basically going to go start, you know, basically the second, you know, company. And I had a couple of realizations basically, you know, sort of about 6 months into the role. The first was that original idea that I was going to start as my second company where the founding team fell apart. We ended up finding a founding team that was just so world-class and way above and beyond anything that I was going to be able to pull together. It was basically this like cybersecurity insurance idea. And we found this team from like the Israeli cybersecurity unit that was just like the best in the world. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I met that team. You're like, oh, you would have kicked my ass. Yeah. There's no, like, I could have founded it. I could have raised money from top tier VCs. Your team would have like, you know, eaten our lunch, like, you know, absolutely no brainer. And so I had this realization, was like, whoa, this is like what like founder market fit looks like. I need to like aspire to this. Like you kind of learned, like, you know, like I learned, I was like, oh, I was actually like a C+ entrepreneur in terms of like, why me, why this market, why this founder, et cetera. I just met A+. I was like, I'm not starting another company until I have like an A+ answer. So I realized like that. And the second thing was about 6 months into the role, I actually ended up like basically sourcing, and we ultimately ended up investing into an aerospace company at Coastal Ventures. And I had this sudden realization where I was like, oh, that original life path where I was like, make it big in normal tech and then go do space. I now have found a way to do space at age 23. So why am I going to do this like deferred life plan? I'm just going to start doing space stuff now. And like, I'm going to work at KV. I'm going to keep doing investments that are in normal like tech land, but I'm going to like, you know, use my KV budget to start going to like space conferences and meeting with space entrepreneurs and understanding more about this ecosystem. And I'm getting paid to do this in a way that is like far more interesting than working at, you know, sort of SpaceX to just be an individual software engineer. I'm going to start doing basically this like, you know, space stuff. And by the way, I actually think that like, you know, maybe my third realization was, I think I might be a better investor than entrepreneur. Like I'm very ADD. I don't really like the people management side of it. I love like the like intellectual curiosity, constantly learning, like, you know, ideating. And then I actually think I'm a better like, you know, sort of therapist to CEOs than I am a CEO myself. Like I kind of, when I'd reflected after about 6 months in the chief of staff role, when I reflected back in the past couple of years, my favorite moments in like Silicon Valley and entrepreneurship were not like with my own company. They were when I was like advising other people's, you know, basically companies. When I was doing like YC mock interviews, I'd done rough draft VC back in the day as like basically like a university run venture fund and funding some of those basically entrepreneurs. And so I was like, man, I like don't think I have a founding team that's A+. I get to do this space stuff today. And by the way, I think I'm a better investor than entrepreneur. I was like, I'm hard pivoting and like leaning into this. And it was sort of like this like, I don't know, you know, swallowing of ego / like reframing how I thought of myself or like up until then.
A little bit of a reinvention.
Yeah. Up until then, I was always like, I'm going to be CEO. I'm going to be CEO. I'm going to be CEO. Yeah. And all of a sudden I had this realization. I was like, I need to do what I am best at. You know, what I can be top 0.1% at.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be top 0.1% in CEO. I've met a bunch of these top 0.1% CEOs and they literally have down to like physical traits, things that I don't have. You know, I come from a family that has like a history of, you know, mental illnesses and a history of insomnia. I'm not great at the like day in, day out, you know, grind where you need to be like in the, you know, factory with the engineers till 2 o'clock in the morning. Because if I'm up until 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm fucking wiped the next day and I take like a week to recover. You can't have that as a CEO. You don't get a week to recover.
Yeah.
Like you have to be back with the team ready to go the next day. And so there's like literally like fundamental like physical things that I just like, you know, don't think that I, you know, sort of, you know, have. Whereas an investor, actually what matters is like 3 or 4 decisions that you make a year.
Two big decisions a year.
Exactly. And so like, you know, if you need to take a week off because you didn't fucking sleep well, actually that like typically doesn't, you know, you generally need to be responsive to have founders and entrepreneurs, et cetera, but you very rarely need to actually be up until 2 o'clock in the morning and grinding basically like, you know, the next day.
Yeah.
And so I was like, fuck this. I'm going to do the thing that I think I can be top 0.1% at because I want to be top in my field. That was part of why I switched from mathematics into like robotic space, et cetera. It was like, I realized I was like, I'm not going to be a top 0.1% mathematician. You know, some of the guys like the founders of Cognition Labs, like Neil and Scott Wu, are going to be top 0.1%.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've met them and I'm like, they have a different brain. And like, I need to go find the thing where my brain is going to be best at.
Yes.
And so, you know, pivoted into, you know, sort of space robotics after, you know, in some ways meeting them. And then again, pivoted when I met all these CEOs and I was like, okay, actually, I think I can be a top 0.1% investor. And so, yeah, I ended up, you know, sort of hardcore leaning into the investing thing and learning a ton from Keith about how to be a world-class investor, entrepreneur, et cetera. And then in some ways, when it came to starting Varda, it was funny. I got a lot of, you know, basically critiques from people that had known me, you know, because my co-founder was not a known entity, let's say, in Silicon Valley. He'd been at SpaceX for 7 years, but SpaceX in some ways is removed from traditional Silicon Valley, right? Like it was down in LA, you know, hardcore aerospace engineering. These are not people that were like hanging out on Sand Hill Road. And so a lot of the people that, you know, knew me around Sand Hill Road, they were like, well, do you not have a conviction in the idea? Like, why aren't you CEO? Like, why is this SpaceX engineer basically, you know, CEO? And I remember explicitly telling him, I was like, look, you can believe me or not, this is my highest conviction move. Like I have such high conviction that I'm not going to be CEO because I know the only way this thing succeeds is if I'm not, because that's not what I am.
That is fucking gold. That is gold. There's a few things I want to highlight. Number one is self-awareness. Like truly doing the work to figure out what you're the N of one at, what you're absolute world-class at, or have the capacity to be world-class at, and then having the humility to find the other people of your caliber in that particular area where you're not as strong in. And number two, I think, is having a long-term approach. You said, okay, I do want to build this space company at some point, but you're getting the reps in as an investor, then you're able to invest in deep tech companies because you're so into the space. You're getting a lot of deal flow, which then helps you later on when you want to recruit for your own company. As you're building Varda now, that increases your deal flow as an investor. There's this beautiful flywheel that happens. So you saw that as, I'm not going to get everything I want right now, but this is a platform where I can launch my larger vision, and everything I'm doing is stacking towards that.
And I'm getting paid now to go to space conferences. I'm getting paid now to like go hang out at the, like, I would go to like the bar by SpaceX like once a month and basically just like hang out with a bunch of my like MIT buddies that were working there and like buy them drinks and dinner, et cetera. Just to be like, if you guys ever want to leave SpaceX and start a company, I want to be basically like your first call. And if one day I want to start something, I want to like us, you know, to basically start it together. Like I explicitly had this conversation with the guy that actually introduced me to my now co-founder and CEO, was originally what I thought was going to be my co-founder and CEO for a variety of reasons. It sort of didn't work out. But I remember telling him like literally like about 6 months into the KV role, I was like, I want us to like start hanging out once a month because we haven't seen each other that much since college. Mm-hmm. And one day I want us to like, you know, start a space company, you know, basically together. I don't know what it is. I don't know how it's going to work, but I want us, you know, basically do this. And I now got to revisit all those industrial ideas and passions that I had. Like now as an investor, I got to meet with the Made in Space executive team. I got to look at the planetary resources, you know, basically like, you know, sort of journey in terms of how it went up and then how it ultimately, you know, sort of folded. I learned so much more now about just like, you know, I learned how small in some ways the space ecosystem was. Mm-hmm. You realize that actually like at the time when I first started working on it in like 2018, there was basically like 15 entrepreneurs that had raised, call it over $30 million in the prior 2 or 3 years.
That's it.
So when you like think about like at the time, what is the space ecosystem? If you're needing to sell into one of these groups or you're needing to partner with them in order to like achieve your solution, it's not like some vague infinite set of companies. It's like 15 people. It's like you can literally know all 15 people. It's obviously the ecosystem has grown a lot, you know, basically since then. Yeah. But at the time, it was, you know, sort of very, you know, sort of very small. And also the investor groups, like who actually invest into these early stage ideas, not very many as well. And so I became, you know, a relatively, again, junior, but like well-known figure in all these groups. All these space entrepreneurs knew me. All these engineers knew me. All these investors knew me. They started to see that I did have some level of taste and was like, you know, actually learning about their industry and their, you know, environment. And then in some ways, ultimately, the way that Varda came together was like I originally approached it just like I would any other investment thesis. I was like, Q4 2019, a Falcon 9 rocket launches and lands for the first time 4 times in a row and actually becomes, you know, sort of reusable in a way that is like to me no longer a fluke, but a pattern. I have now friends that are at SpaceX working on Falcon 9. And so I call them and I'm like, hey, how's the wear and tear? Can you go from like 4 landings to 20 to 40 to 100? And the resounding feedback was like, absolutely yes. And Starship is coming online. And so I was like, great. I'm now at this platform. We had switched over to, you know, sort of Founders Fund together, but was continuing to basically, you know, do the exact same investor job. And so I was like, great. Let me go spend a ton of time with people that are working on this idea and basically tell them now that Falcon 9 is reusable, screw the like, you know, sort of research, you know, type activity that we're doing on the ISS. Let's go start doing this like mass manufacturing. And I've got a $10 million check because I've got the backing of Founders Fund. Let's basically go do this. And so I seriously like underwrote, you know, sort of 4 or 5 different companies that were basically the early innings of the companies that were working on this and basically got the resounding feedback. Hey, yes, Falcon 9 is reusable. Yes, in space manufacturing, it would be cheaper and more cost effective if done fully autonomously rather than inside of a human rated station. However, we are companies that, you know, very closely cooperate with NASA and NASA is our primary funder.
Yeah.
NASA is not funding this. And so we are not going to do this. And so it was just like one of these moments where I remember like Q1 2020, literally my last trip right before COVID hit, I was actually here in Florida, up in Jacksonville, meeting with a couple of like entrepreneurs. And I got back home to San Francisco and I was like, I am like at a dead end. I spent 5 months now and I've met with like 100+ people. Nobody's willing to do this idea. And to me, it felt so obvious. I was like, I don't even understand what's going on here. Like I keep talking to all these like space industry experts that like, you know, I've come to gotten to know over the past 3 or 4 years, again, through this platform. And they all keep telling me this idea is impossible. And like from a first principles, like I'm no space engineer, but like I'm a physicist. I understand like, you know, how this, you know, stuff generally works. There's no reason why this shouldn't work. Like, you know, sending automated space factories to orbit, super doable. Send them on Falcon 9s. You put them on top of a satellite rather than on top of a space station. And by the way, the like space factory thing is the same thing that they're doing on the International Space Station. So that's been done. And then the other thing that everybody was terrified of was like, can you bring the like medications back down? And I was like, these reentry capsules, like, yes, like they're complicated if you have humans on board, you gotta keep them surviving.
Yeah.
But like we just have medications on board. We don't need to like have life support systems. We don't have oxygen. We don't even need to maintain G forces that badly. Like you and I can't rip 10 Gs for 3 minutes straight. We die. the medications could care less if they rip, you know, basically 10 Gs, you know, for 3 minutes straight. And so it was like one of those moments where I, like, I put the thesis on the shelf, but that was probably the first inkling where I was like, huh, I'm not happy that I'm putting this like thesis on the shelf. And I feel like I've got a unique insight here and I've got the right answer for like founder market fit. And so like, you know, I remember in like, you know, May 2020, I tweet for the first time. And this was like where it really started to kick off is like, I basically tweeted like this, like, you know, tweet that was like, you know, positing one idea after another, which is basically like, you know, low interest rate environment, cheapest cost of capital ever. Therefore, you know, we also have, you know, the cheapest cost of access to orbit. Therefore, now is basically the best time in human history to start a capital intensive, like ambitious, basically deep tech, like space company. And I remember I hit tweet, the tweet goes super viral. And then I'm like reading my tweet myself. And then I'm like, oh God.
I just talked myself into this.
I literally just talked myself into this. And I remember that same week, I basically like, had a little like retreat with Keith out in like Malibu. Cause we were like losing our minds being totally solo. We're like, okay, we'll do this like distance retreat. We'll stay outside, et cetera. We're like going on this hike. And he's like talking about like what we should be spending our time. Cause like we weren't investing, you know, that much of the time. And he's like, well, look, you should like, you know, you founded a company before. We like to incubate companies within the firm. You should incubate and like build something. That's like a really great way to spend your time. And I remember I was just like thinking, I was like, oh, well, I've learned what it's like to not have an A-plus team with the right founder market fit. And I was like, well, the only idea that I have that I know I have a very unique insight on, because I've talked to everybody, I know nobody else is working on this, is this in-space manufacturing idea. This is kind of the thing that I've been obsessed with since I was like in fifth grade. And so like the motivation that I had for this idea is very different than what I had in terms of motivation for Nightingale. Yeah. So to be able to like actually chew the glass, go through the trenches, like, you know, we've had, it's not been a exactly linear journey for Varda. Many, many times we've had, you know, plenty of challenges. And it was funny, and I can talk about this, you know, later, but like, you know, in some of those challenges, I remember regressing into some of my like Nightingale demotivated mindset. But then you wake up the day later and be like, fuck that. This is the life's work. Like, I get why I got demotivated with Nightingale, but like, you're not going to allow yourself to get demotivated this time around.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I basically, you know, in like, you know, April, May 2020, I was like, okay, maybe I should start considering this. And so then I started to pencil out over the course of the next month. I was like, okay, what would I do like as an investor? How would I evaluate this idea? What would convince me basically of this idea? And I was like, well, here is the ideal, like, you know, sort of co-founder, like, you know, sort of traits. Here are the three people that you need. You basically want somebody from SpaceX that had worked on Dragon, because ultimately, if everybody keeps telling me the reentry capsule is the hardest part, well, what commercial company has built a reentry capsule? SpaceX with Dragon. And it's not that big of a team, right? Like, you know, there are a lot of technicians that are, but if you look at the core design engineering team, it was like, you know, basically 100 people, you know, like, you know, in the like critical parts of it. And so it's not like an infinite set of people to pull from in terms of co-founder. So a co-founder needs to have been from that team, and ideally like great reputation, somebody that like a lot of people really admired. Second, I need to recruit one of these like scientists that has actually done work in microgravity on the International Space Station. They need to be a co-founder. And then third, well, this is actually the perfect company where I have the founder market fit, where I have the idea. This is going to be a capital intensive company. And so having a VC as a co-founder actually makes a ton of sense, because you're going to be fundraising, you know, basically quite a bit and early on. And I was like, okay, great. This is what I need. And I remember telling my, you know, now wife at the time, girlfriend, I was like, there's no way. Like, there's one of 100 people that have like worked on Dragon. There's like probably 30 scientists that have done, you know, legitimate work on the International Space Station. The idea that I find them and we actually agree on like, and we actually get along and we get like equity splits, I was like, zero fucking chance. Like, there's no way that this happens. So great, I'll work on this for the summer. And then after the summer, I'll say I've given it my best go, and then I'll wait, and one day somebody else will do it, and I'll just like, you know, invest in them, and I'll keep a, you know, tight tune on it. And then like mid-September hits, and it turns out I found the co-founder from SpaceX. I found the co-founder scientist that had done work on the ISS, and we agreed on equity splits. And I remember like the night before we were basically like, you know, going to, you know, basically like do the incorporation docs and actually like set it up. I remember telling my wife, I was like, what? Like, how did this happen?
How did this
like, this was not supposed to happen. Like, this was supposed to be the 1% outcome where I was actually doing this. And I was like, I don't want to do this.
But that's brilliant, because you were so crystal clear on what would need to happen for you to pull this off. You remind me, and again, you do remind me a lot of Elon, because he's like, it doesn't matter how hard the problem is. I just want to do important work. If it's important, I'm going to do it. And you could not find a CEO, you told me, that you had conviction prior to the one you brought on, but you didn't find someone who you thought could build this company without you involved and do it the right way. So you're like, you know what? I'd rather be an investor, but this is so important. It has to get done the right way that I have to be involved with this and make it my life's work. And I think that's really important for people looking for their callings, that want to do their best work and be world-class, is to find that founder market fit of what is the thing that just captivates my soul, that it has to be an expression of who I am in this earth. But I'm curious for you, Elon said when he started SpaceX, he's like, I knew it was a big moonshot, but I thought maybe I had a 10% chance of success. In your mind, what do you think your chances of success are?
Oh man, I mean, today, obviously much higher than like when we started. When we started, very low, but I was like, we got to at least give this like, you know, sort of a fair shot, because like, I feel like humanity needs somebody to give this, you know, a fair shot. I actually think at this point, in terms of like success, which I'll call, let's say like $10 billion of market capitalization, regularly flying flights, generating value for pharmaceutical customers, I actually think we have like a 40 or 50% chance now, which is like crazy. Cause like obviously 4 years ago, it was like sub 1%. Like there were so many things that could have gone, you know, sort of wrong to not get to this point. And again, it's a little bit more of like still a, you know, sort of coin flip going forward.
Yeah.
But still it's like coin flip on like pretty massive, you know, sort of, you know, outcome.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I think when you're talking about like, you know, sort of finding your calling, you know, I think, it reminds me of like the early conversations that I had with my, you know, sort of co-founder, you know, back then, where he was originally going on a completely different, you know, sort of trend in his career, let's say trajectory. He'd worked at SpaceX for a long time, but he was actually planning on just like not working in aerospace again, doing completely basically unrelated, you know, sort of business activities. He actually, funnily enough, was going to start an autism technology, you know, basically company, was his like, you know, sort of pre-existing, you know, sort of plan.
Comes together then.
And so I like, you know, basically, you know, get on the first phone call with him and I was like, look, like, your destiny, like, let me tell you, like, you know, I did the autism technology thing. It's not going to be a great outcome. You don't, you're not the person for it. But let me pitch you on what I think your real calling is. I know you've never heard of or even thought really about in-space manufacturing, but the CEO of an in-space manufacturing company would have your exact skill set, your exact personality, et cetera. Let me like walk you through like, you know, this vision and like, you know, let me convince you that this should be what you do instead of what you're currently doing. And again, credit to him, went from like extreme skeptic to within like basically a month of us spending time together and understanding the idea, also came to the realization like, holy shit, this is the thing that I was meant to do. This is actually the, you know, sort of like the life's, you know, sort of work. And again, same thing with the third co-founder around, he had done this work on the ISS, but now, you know, sort of transitioning, you know, sort of off of it. But yeah, no, definitely, you know, feel like we've got a much better shot at, you know, sort of pulling it off today.
Yeah.
Still a long journey, you know, ahead of us though.
So I'm really curious to actually break this down in as much layman's terms as we can, because it's hard to even articulate this company in a simple fashion, but I think you do a great job at it. So just to give people a sense of what you're building, the complexity here, and I want to dive into it. I'll butcher this, but I'd love to hear you fill in the gaps here. So you essentially are sending rockets into outer space using SpaceX rockets.
Yep.
Into low orbit.
Yep. As close to Earth as possible.
As close to Earth as possible, because there is microgravity.
Yep.
Which creates different conditions, which allow us to make different drugs that we otherwise couldn't manufacture on Earth, because the chemicals, the compounds, they act differently in space. You then are manufacturing drugs that can be used. What types of drugs? For like Alzheimer's, what types of drugs are you guys
building? It's all types, and maybe it'll be helpful to first start off with just like a simple, you know, sort of physics analogy. So, you know, on the table in front of us, we both have, you know, sort of glasses of water. You know very intuitively what would happen if I basically dropped a chunk of ice basically into that glass of water, right? It'll dip down for a little bit and then it'll bob back up and it'll basically float to the top.
Yeah.
So why is that actually happening on a very fundamental physics level? Ice and water, basically when it crystallizes into ice, becomes a lattice structure of a crystalline structure that is actually less dense than the liquid version basically of water.
Right.
So basically those atoms are actually packed together less tightly than when it's in a water form. And when they're less tight, it's less dense.
So
and in a fluid or a gas, basically the less dense part of it rises to the top. Now, imagine you and I were sitting on the International Space Station. We had these glasses of water in front of us. And obviously I can't drop the glass of ice or the ice cube because there's no gravity. But imagine I throw the ice cube a little bit basically towards into your water. Well, what happens? The ice cube still basically goes into the water, but again, there's no up, there's no down. And so it doesn't float to the top. It'll just sit in the middle of the water, basically, if you want. And so imagine that we had a drug where a requirement for the manufacturing of it was that you created a bathtub filled with ice, but we needed to basically like flash freeze it. And when we flash freezed it, we needed there to be ice perfectly distributed all throughout the bathtub, all throughout the water, basically, such that there was, you know, one ice cube every 6 inches or something like that. Well, you try and do that here on Earth. The moment you put the ice cube down at the bottom of the bathtub, it just floats to the top. And again, you could say, okay, well, what if we put a bunch of metal rods there to hold it in place, et cetera, but now the metal rods are changing the chemical reaction, et cetera. And so what you can think of is like basically what we're doing up in orbit is we're taking these things that just require dense and less dense things to be configured in a way that does not allow them to be configured basically down here on Earth, where you want the ice cubes in the middle of the water, basically in the top of the water.
And what is possible through that? Like what types of breakthroughs in pharmaceuticals are available there?
Yeah, so I'll give two examples. One that's basically the, you know, sort of best case study from the International Space Station, and then one that's our first commercial contract that will be, you know, basically flying, you know, this summer. First of a few commercial contracts. Merck took one of their blockbuster cancer drugs known as Keytruda. It's used in a ton of different, you know, sort of types of cancers. And the issue with Keytruda today, when it's manufactured here on Earth, is when it's taken from basically like a unstable form into a crystalline form, the crystal chunks that it forms vary a ton in size. And I'll describe very simply as to why it varies in size. Think of basically when they're crystallizing it, what they're doing is they're taking, imagine like that tub of water. Mm-hmm. And what they're basically doing is they're slightly freezing. And inside the tub of water, there's little chunks of basically salt. And what happens when it, you know, freezes together is the little chunks of salt will all form together and clump up. But now at the moment that it's clumped up, you now have this clump that is more dense. And by the way, you have a bunch of now liquid around it that is less dense. And so what happens is the clump moves down and the less dense part of it, you know, imagine before it was all perfectly even, right? It was water and little like chunks of salt all perfectly even all throughout the tub. The moment that now it starts to, you know, sort of crystallize and form, that heavier chunk moves down and all that lighter stuff that's empty around it now moves up. And so what ends up happening is like basically as they're crystallizing it, there's a bunch of chunks that form early on that become very big, but then there's some leftover salt in little areas that clump up, mm-hmm. and then they actually form much smaller, basically like crystalline structures. And because the salt was all emptied out around them, they just stay small. And so now when you look at basically when they crystallize this drug, what are the size of the crystals, basically those clumps that formed? It's very a wide distribution of different types of crystals and sizes. And so what does that mean when they actually deliver the basically, you know, sort of cancer drug into your bloodstream? What it means is those clumps break down very differently. The little clumps break down very quickly. The big clumps take a while. Mm-hmm. And the issue is for you as a patient, what that means is it really changes how the drug is actually dosing in your bloodstream. So the way that they control for this is what they do is they actually instead basically have you come into the clinic every day. They do an intravenous drip into your bloodstream. And basically if a part of the drug that they give you is a little bit bigger clumps, they'll go throw more of the drug in so that you start to get more dosing, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. If you happen to get a dose that is a bunch of little chunks, they'll be more careful in the dosing and basically only give you a little bit of a time. And so they basically use an IV machine and basically a thing that monitors your dosing to basically manually control how much, you know, basically of the cancer drug you have in your bloodstream. And so you have to come into the clinic basically every single day as a cancer patient for 1 to 4 hours to basically have this drug administered. Wow. And so it's not a great experience because obviously it's hugely disruptive to, you know, if you have a job or anything like that, it's not a great patient experience. Now, they took that same drug, they ran that same process up in space. What ends up happening? So again, imagine that we have that bathtub, we have a bunch of those little salt chunks. We say, hey, salt chunks, start crystallizing. Well, they start clumping together, they crystallize. But again, this is more dense, but you're inside of microgravity. So what happens? It just sits there. Yeah. It doesn't move around.
Perfect
it doesn't.
Distribution.
And so now you look, all the crystals, they're all perfectly distributed and they're all the exact same size. And so they take it down to Earth and now you have all these little crystals that are the exact same size. So what does that mean now as a patient? Well, now I know exactly how it's going to break down in your bloodstream per unit volume, basically, of the drug. And so rather than you having to come into an IV clinic, I can just say, hey, go to the pharmacy once a week. I'll give you 7 syringes that you got to put in your fridge. And then just once a day, you can basically just inject yourself with a syringe and you don't have to come into the clinic basically anymore. And so they showed that they could massively improve basically the like delivery mechanism of this drug, right? And this is a drug that is $25 billion a year of revenue for them.
Wow.
If they were able to commercialize basically that work that they had on the International Space Station, one, you would cut out a ton of costs for the patients because now you don't have to do basically these like IV clinics anymore. The like nurses that are administering it, obviously the patient experience is much improved. So that would be a huge, you know, sort of benefit. Second, as the company that's producing it, Merck, they would get an additional 5 years of patent life on this drug. And so now it means an additional $125 billion of basically protected revenues of this drug. And, this allows them to, you know, innovate on this particular, you know, sort of cancer compound where they could actually ideally apply this to a ton of different, you know, sort of cancer compounds. It's not just, you know, sort of this one. But despite the fact that Merck basically found this result in 2019, that IP and that innovation is basically sat on the shelf. Wow. Because they can't go to NASA and basically be like, shut down your entire International Space Station, let us do mass manufacturing of like our drug. That's just like not what NASA is for. That's not what the ISS is for.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, sort of one example from the ISS. I'll give you another example that's from this upcoming basically summer.
Yeah.
So we're going to be working on a next generation cancer compound known as a KRAS inhibitor. KRAS inhibitors basically work on this protein that is the protein that basically in your body tells the human cell basically when to replicate. And in about 30% of cancers, a mutation that causes that protein to be overproduced or overexpressed is the fundamental cause of the cancer. Because basically, there's a mutation, this protein gets produced too much, that makes the cells basically replicate too much, and basically cells replicating too much is effectively, you know, what a cancer is. The issue with trying to find something that disables, you know, this type of protein is the molecules that disable it, because the protein is quite large and complex, the molecules that disable it are quite large and complex. And so when they try and take that same process of, again, imagine a like tub of, you know, basically water with a bunch of salts, basically individual salt crystals. When they try and get them to clump together and crystallize down here on Earth, the issue is these salts are way more complex and they're way more floppy. And so you can kind of think of it as like the molecule is not very good at like hugging itself down here on Earth. And so it just refuses to clump together at all. And so instead they're stuck with what's known as this like amorphous solid version, where you do have these like little salt chunks. But it's basically not a like larger form. It's not a larger crystalline chunk. Mm-hmm. And so it's very, very unstable. This is the exact type of issue that's been shown to be able to be solved in microgravity, where these very floppy hydrocarbon arms on in gravity, anytime you heat them up, cool them down, et cetera, they're constantly flopping around. There's convective currents, et cetera. It's hard for them to crystallize. This is the exact type of thing that's been able to be shown to be, you know, solved basically up in microgravity. And the best part is, once you make, call it like 2 to 5 grams of that crystalline basically clump up in microgravity, you actually can take it down here on Earth, put that into a vat. And now that there's already a chunk, it's actually easier for the individual salts to now attach to this pre-existing chunk. And so it actually grows around it like a sourdough starter model. Basically what we're doing is we're going up into space, making the like 2 to 5 grams of this like next generation cancer compound, forming the sourdough starter, basically crystalline seed crystal, as it's called, which you can't make down here on Earth.
Wow.
And then using that to now seed terrestrial manufacturing that enables this next generation cancer compound that could actually tackle a significant portion of cancers. That's been this like basically holy grail pursuit for a lot of the pharmaceutical
industry. Believe the next breakthrough of like a massive wave in solving diseases here on Earth is to be found in microgravity in space?
I think there's going to be a ton of waves over the next decade, right? There's a lot of interesting works.
That's just one vehicle for that?
Yeah, there's gene therapy, cell therapies, et cetera. Yeah. But I think when you look at more, let's say, fundamental sort of chemistry-based pharmaceuticals, right? So, you know, not things that are in the world of like cell, biological, you know, sort of materials, et cetera. Yeah, I think we're basically the most interesting chemistry, basically, innovation in the past like 20 years. And if you look at it today, look, while there's a lot of interesting things happening in gene therapy, et cetera, there's not many of those, you know, sort of pharmaceuticals yet on the market. 90% of the market is still basically chemistry-based pharmaceuticals. And so, you know, I do think that will help advance a lot of very interesting net new chemistries, including this, you know, type of cancer breakthrough. And so,
Fascinating.
That customer will be flying with us, you know, this summer with a couple of other customers. And hopefully it's one that we'll be able to announce, I think, in like the next, like, you know, call it 4 weeks or so.
So you are manufacturing these drugs in low orbit in outer space. You have the infrastructure set up there. Then once those drugs are created, then you shoot them back down on a spacecraft.
Yep.
Which you just had your first one land about a month ago.
Yep.
Which is incredible. So now you've proved out this and now you're on the next leg of the journey, which is actually like manufacturing these drugs and doing your iterations here. It's just fascinating. What would you say over the last couple of years has been the highest high and the lowest low at Varda?
I mean, the lowest low is a very obvious day, you know, August 29th, 2023. We thought that we were basically all set for a landing on September, I want to say like 5th, basically, of 2023. And all of our approvals got pulled out for reasons that I would say were pretty, you know, sort of nonsensical and felt sort of outside of our control. We're basically, I argue when people say like the, you know, sort of deep state actors that are trying to screw you over, that is basically exactly what we went through, where there was an individual in the US government that decided that he wasn't a huge fan of Varda and decided to pull out all the stops to do his best to basically prevent us from being able to land. Mm-hmm. And he basically held us up, you know, for about, you know, sort of 6 months because—
What was going through your head there?
I mean, the question was, well, this individual has a decent amount of power and it will take us quite a bit of time to circumvent his power structure.
How did you do that?
I'll
call Elon or?
No, it's calling a lot of members of Congress, calling our supporters within the Air Force. It was just a lot of, you know, sort of You can think of the U.S. government as, in some ways, I think, just like the largest, you know, sort of enterprise in the world. And so, in some ways, what you're doing is just classic enterprise sales.
You got to find the champion who can get you.
We have the
over procurement.
Exactly. We have the anti-champion, and now we have to figure out who can control the anti-champion, who actually, you know, sort of has some jurisdiction over what he does, and get them all to be champions, so that even kicking and screaming, this person did not want us to land in February. They were still, even in the final hours, trying to figure out how to sabotage, you know, basically the operation. But August 29th is just like, you know, is this saboteur going to now hold up the company for years on end in a way that, like, you know, this is so hard to pull off. You're burning capital every month that you're just sitting there up
and one guy is standing in between you.
Yeah. And this could be the thing. It could have, like, you know, basically killed the company, where it's just like, you know, we could have run out of capital and, like, not ever been able to land. And investors would have lost interest in the company because it lost momentum. You, like, start to lose, you know, sort of talent. So that was, you know, sort of by far the worst day. You know, for me, the best day was, I think, in some ways more launch than reentry. I think I was just, like, so stressed about reentry and had been, like, such a painful journey up until that point.
Yeah.
Versus launch was just one of these moments where I was like, man, like, we made it here. And also, you know, it's so low risk, at least for the first, like, you know, 15 minutes, because, like, SpaceX is not going to blow up the rocket. You know, we then have to, like, figure out how to contact our satellite and spool it up and everything. And that could go wrong. But at least I know it's not going to blow up in the next 15 minutes. And so that was a very sort of fun day. I probably got a little more drunk than I should have that day.
I love it, man. I want to shift a little bit into some advice you have. You have a lot of controversial tweets that I love, right? And
I don't mean to be controversial. I just say
you
what
have
I mean.
Strong opinions, right? Yeah. Actually, you speak the truth, and the truth is going to have, it's going to activate people on both sides. But, like, you have some really interesting points. And one tweet you said, I think you had, like, this 30 lessons you learned at 30 years old, right? It was a good tweet list. One thing you mentioned is marry well and marry early, right? You're 30. You just had your first child. You're married. I just had Emil Michael, the cheapest suffers Uber, on the show. And, you know, he had sacrificed his whole career, didn't have his first kid till, I think, like, late 40s, early 50s. And he's like, that was the price I paid for the career, man. But I'm curious how you think about being an iconic, world-changing entrepreneur and also prioritizing, like, family, marriage. Like, why do you think it's so important to marry well and early versus go build your career and then maybe save that for later? What's your relationship there?
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we're all going to be space dust in 100 years. And so, you know, I think career is important. And obviously, I want to do ambitious things and impact the world. But so is, like, establishing a legacy and enjoying the time that we have on Earth. And at least, you know, for somebody that comes from a very, I think in Eastern Europe, it's a very family-oriented, you know, sort of culture, and it's where I derive the most joy. I'm very close with my, you know, sort of parents and siblings, and it's, you know, something that I highly, you know, sort of prioritize. And, you know, I always, even as a kid, you know, thought of it as, you know, 30 was kind of the latest that I wanted to, you know, have kids, you know, sort of, if not, you know, ideally, you know, sort of earlier. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I think, yeah, it's just like, what else are you here on this earth for? Like, you know, I got to, you know, before this podcast, spend 2 hours in the morning with my, like, you know, 4 month old son, and just, like, playing and giggling and, you know, feeding him his morning, you know, sort of meal. And I start every morning basically like that. And it's just like, what more glorious way could one possibly, you know, sort of live life? What at work, what accomplishment, what could actually derive that level of joy, right? Anything that Varda does pales in comparison to, like, you know, my 4 month old son giggling to me in the mornings. And so I think, you know, I just think it is the thing that you're here on this planet to do. You're here to extend consciousness. I do that as best as I can professionally by hoping to make, you know, sort of humanity multiplanetary through industrial means. But the most practical way that I can do it is bring together a sperm and an egg to make another human that is going to extend consciousness for even, you know, sort of longer. And so, yeah, I don't know. I just think, like, it's never worth the sacrifice. Like, you know, it's just, have the kid. You're going to figure it out. Like, you know, cavemen figured it out. Your ancestors figured it out. If you're telling me you really can't figure it out, you probably have bigger problems in terms of, like, your ability to just, like, understand, like, who you are and what you are and why you're on this earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, I do think there are aspects of just, like, you know, marriage as well that are just so compounding, where, you know, I think people are just not good at understanding that so much of life is, like, an accumulating advantage. And, you know, riding the, like, sort of exponential curve. And I think, like, you know, my relationship with my wife is, like, the perfect example of this, where, because we've been married now for 5 years, she's gotten to watch me over the course of this ride of Varda, and I've gotten to watch her, you know, sort of career ride as well. And you form this, like, depth of a relationship that is very different than people that are meeting much later on in life after they've basically, like, had their success and had their, you know, sort of journeys. Mm. You don't get to make the memories of the journey along, you know, sort of the way together. And that, I think, in some ways is so defining of the relationship. And I think, I don't know, most men today, especially in like the, you know, sort of liberal cities of New York and San Francisco, just have this like Peter Pan syndrome where, you know, they're just like, you know, stuck in this, like, I watch some friends like I was roommates with when I was like 19, 20, and I see them sometimes on like social media, et cetera. And I'm like, you still have the same life. You still live in like a group house in San Francisco. You still fuck around and like, you know, do random things like, you know, on the weekend. You have nothing that you're building towards. Like your life is the exact same. You're in stasis.
It's just all pleasure seeking distraction.
It's hedonistic treadmill. And what do you think you're going to think about when you're like, you know, 85 years old and on your deathbed? Are you going to be happy that you had like a couple of more like burner parties? Or are you going to be happy that you got to meet your great grandchildren? And to me, it's a no brainer. I want to be alive to be able to meet my great grandchildren. And the only way to do that is you have to have the children first so that they have the grandkids pretty soon and the great grandkids, you know,
right? I like your mindset on that. I think the funny thing about entrepreneurs is a lot of entrepreneurs were building out of like insecurity at first. Like we, you know, a lot of times you're rejected early on in life. You got some sort of trauma or you got something you want to prove something to the world. And we want all these accomplishments and accolades so we can feel worthy, so we can feel worthy of receiving love and actually have love. But ultimately all the accolades, all the things we just want love and acceptance from other humans. So why make that a delayed thing? And why not just prioritize finding the people that you love most and building with them and having that compound interest?
Yeah, and just being comfortable with commitment. Like I think, you know, most 25-year-olds in San Francisco are not comfortable with the idea of like, am I filtering for the person that I'm dating right now being the person that I'm going to commit to for the rest of my life? It's like a scary, you know, concept for them versus, I don't know. I dated very, dated a lot from like ages like, 14, 15 for my first girlfriend all the way up until I was about 21, 22.
Yeah.
And then I actually basically did not date seriously for 3 or 4 years because I sort of shifted my mindset where I was like, great, I've dated a decent number of women and I understand basically, you know, sort of what I'm looking for, what I like in a partner, what I don't like in a partner. I'm not going to date again until like I've basically like found like the person and like I don't need to do like a.
You were dating to marry at that point, like massive intention.
Yeah. It was just like I was dating to marry, and the next person that I
similar to your business selection to your like next company I start, it's going to be the one.
Yeah, for sure. Fuck around till you're 20, 21 and like learn about what you're looking for.
Yeah.
But once you have, like, commit to what you're looking for.
I like that mindset a lot. That's a really good mental model. It's like experiment like hell, whether it's dating, whether it's companies, whether it's working in businesses, experiment like crazy, get the reps. Gain the self-awareness you need. And then once you have that self-awareness, raise your standard as high as you can and be very selective about where you put your energy.
And the more controversial opinion that I put out there is like, and these things are correlated. Like if I find somebody that is like, you know, sort of 35-year-old Peter Pan in San Francisco has never been able to like, you know, marry, et cetera, but like talks about being like a, you know, sort of husband, but has never, you know, married anybody. To me, it's like, well, okay, if you have this like, you know, sort of fault in your personal life, it almost certainly shows up in your professional life as well.
Like a lack of commitment.
Yeah, it's like, okay, if you can't commit to a wife, like why do I think you're gonna be able to commit to a company? Mm. So, you know, I think, you know, I do think, you know, there are these correlations as you're describing them in terms of, get the reps and then commit. But, you know, these correlations also extend, you know, later in life if you aren't able to do those things. And so I definitely, you know, read these things as signals. I'm very happy to, you know, say very publicly that I am negatively predisposed towards founders that, you know, have, you know, let's say flaws in their personal life that almost certainly will, you know, show up in their professional life. A lot of the, you know, sort of founders that I invested in are people that married early and had kids early. I'm perfectly fine filtering out people that don't do that.
Yeah, it's interesting. What do you think of Elon in that case, having like 10 or 11 kids with multiple wives?
What does that
say about him as an entrepreneur?
He has, you know, sort of issues in his personal life that probably are not going to make him happy on his deathbed, but I'm not sure that it necessarily.
Because there's success and there's fulfillment.
Yeah.
Right? One's a science, one's an art.
Totally.
You know, but that's a good thesis. I like that a lot.
And again, he did still marry early and had kids early.
He did, actually. You're right. You're right. You know,
you know, had fun after that.
A few last questions for you. To all the entrepreneurs out there, through all your collective experience, what are one or two skills that you think all entrepreneurs should really focus on mastering?
I think probably one of the most important skills is just understanding, you know, people and how to, you know, use the same self-awareness that I think I've used to understand my own skill set and where I'm top 1%. And actually be able to apply that to others in a relatively limited set of data. You obviously, you know, get to live with yourself all day, every day, and hopefully learn about, you know, what you're great at. But in an interview setting, you don't have an infinite amount of time to do that. And so I think the thing that has in some ways, you know, sort of made Varda or made my career is the fact that I've just spent so much time taking pitches, interviewing candidates, spending so much time basically just like assessing people, you know, sort of nonstop. And I think that, you know, sort of skill is what has led us to being able to pull together a really phenomenal, you know, sort of team, because ultimately the team is the people basically, you know, sort of behind it. And so I forced myself, for example, there was a role in the summer of 2022 that I needed to hire at Varda that was incredibly critical. And I forced myself as like the, you know, sort of founder of the company to be the top of funnel. I talked to each individual candidate, first phone screen, second phone screen, you know, through to onsite, et cetera. By the time we like hired the person we ended up hiring, I probably talked to like over 100 candidates. And again, these were like highly qualified candidates for the role. It's not like I was talking to like 100 random people, you know, sort of off the street. And I think being willing to do those reps rather than, I think most founders will shield themselves from that and just be like a recruiting team or exec recruiter.
Just delegate, et cetera. Abdicate responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. And then like, you know, I'll just interview the like top five candidates or whatever right. to like, you know, make my time efficient. But then what it turns out is like you actually learn a lot through the 100 interviews that yes. make you much better at assessing basically.
That is the key, final, man. It's the five. Reps. It's the reps. It's the thousands of layups and three-pointers you shoot in practice when no one's looking. It's just the insane amount of reps that gives you the pattern recognition, that gives you the intuition to then be a genius.
And the only way to become a good people assessor is, yeah, through the reps. And I think that's basically the most important skill of a founder. And then the second is storytelling. And again, I would say it's the reps. Like I, you know, recently gave this, you know, presentation at a relatively prominent like investment, you know, sort of banking conference and just knocked it out of the park. And I made it seem like it was a very casual, you know, threw in a couple jokes, et cetera. But the only reason that it, you know, sort of came off as such a strong story and so casual is I'd spent basically like the week prior every day, all day, four plus hours, rep, and down to like intonation, the pauses, the like specific word choices,
the details.
And when you finally deliver it, it seems like it's very casual, but actually this thing has been perfectly architected. Like I always tell people, the best presentations you give are either totally off the cuff, like this type of conversation, or they're like the extremely practiced. You never want to land in between where it's you can tell that you're just reading off a script in your head, basically. You want to get to the point where you've actually so perfected the script that you're actually back to making it feel like it's natural, just the other person doesn't realize. Like the, you know, in some ways I kind of joke, like the Nathan Fielder, the rehearsal, you know, type you know, TV show. Anyways, it's a, you know, sort of funny TV show where he has people nonstop rehearse personal situations, you know, before they actually, you know, sort of happen. And yeah, so I think, you know, the only way to get great at storytelling again is also, you know, the reps, but it's so critical because at the end of the day, what is a company? Is it it's story and it's people. Everything else is kind of a rounding error.
That's brilliant, man. That's brilliant. Before I ask my last question, where can our audience follow you, engage with you online?
Probably the most entertaining is on Twitter, you know, @ZeBulgar, ZeBulgar.
Highly recommend following Delian. He's pretty entertaining on Twitter. Love it. So you mentioned in another tweet that you had three goals when you were 25 to hit when you turned 30. It was be a father, start a successful space company, and then be a partner at a $1 billion venture firm. You did all three of those things by 30. What do your next three goals look like?
You know, they somewhat relate to, you know, sort of all three, which is on the venture side. Ideally would like to be on the Midas list, you know, 5 years from today. On the, you know, sort of company side, ideally, you know, sort of $10 billion, you know, enterprise, you know, market cap on the NASDAQ. And then on the, you know, sort of family side, you know, have the first kid. Ideally would like to have four kids.
Four? You're going after it, man.
So, yeah. So in some ways, all still related to, you know, sort of all three, you know, sort of categories. I'm sure by like the next set, you know, when I'm 35 and thinking about the goals by 40, I might start to diversify in terms of topics. But for now, just sticking to the same topics.
Yeah, I like your radical focus.
Yeah.
Because you're really playing in the compound effect. It's like I have these three most important pillars in my life. And I'm just going to go all in and just create, the chains will keep moving, but I'm progressing in the most important areas versus like, all right, now I'm going to be a professional guitar player.
Yeah. Maybe that'll be what I decided. Maybe that'll be it
on the following five. Exactly. You still got more work to do here. I mean, this is inspiring as hell, man. I hope all the dreamers out there get some inspiration, get some espresso in their step, just to like go after and chase their big goals. But also I think just to go get the reps, to go out there, throw themselves out in the unknown, get the experience they need, but also not lose sight of that childhood dream and like really go after it. So thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the World Class Podcast. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe across all our platforms. Hit that notification bell so you can get updates on our new episodes, and we'll see you next week.